Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. California's recall process is broken. It may well be unconstitutional and undemocratic. With the upcoming recall election, we'll explore these issues and discuss potential reforms.
I'm Doug Becker. On Tuesday, September 14th, California voters are tasked with choosing whether to recall their current governor, Gavin Newsom, and replace him with one of 46 candidates of varying experience and seriousness. This process has uncovered a serious challenge to the governability of the state based on, ironically, its progressive history and mechanisms that were originally seemingly put in place to ensure democracy. But from a wide-ranging practice of the use of state-level propositions to this admittedly bizarre recall process, the state faces a governability crisis. On today's show, we will discuss the recall process, whether or not it's constitutional, whether or not it's democratic, and whether this process, again, intended to promote direct democracy, is actually undermining democracy within the state. Our guests are Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Berkeley Law School. He's the author of We the People, a Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, and his latest Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And Henry Brady, the former dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and professor of political science and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age, and The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. Thank you both for joining us. Erwin Chemerinsky, I will start with you. Is this recall process, is it even constitutional?
I think the process that's set up by the California Constitution violates the United States Constitution. If Gavin Newsom loses in the recall election, it's likely that 48 or 49% of the people will want to stay as governor. On the other hand, when it comes to the second question on the ballot, according to current polls, the person to be chosen will get about 18%. So what we'll end up with is a governor favored by 18%, chosen over someone favored by 48 or 49%. Not only is that nonsensical, but it's also unconstitutional. My colleague Aaron Edlin and I wrote a couple of op-eds explaining this. The Supreme Court for over half a century has stressed one person, one vote. Everyone should have an equal say in determining the results of an election. This is an election to decide who's the governor. To allow 18% to control over the wishes of 48 or 49% is inconsistent with that constitutional principle.
And so with that in mind, Henry Brady, is this democratic?
It's not democratic either. And part of what Erwin just said shows you that. There's just so many peculiarities to this law. It is the easiest recall procedure amongst all the 19 states that even have recalls. And second of all, it's got this bizarre situation where you have the two questions. Only Colorado does it the same way. And let me just go through that quickly, what that involves. First, how easy it is. In eight states, you have to actually say that the governor has committed some malfeasance or he or she is incompetent or something that really indicates something really bad about the governor. In California, you just have to say, hey, I really don't like the guy. That's really what it amounts to. Second of all, you can do it at any time during the period during which the person is governor. In Michigan, you can't do it in the first year or the last year of the governor's term. And that's essentially to avoid frivolous elections. Third, you actually don't have to get but 12% of the people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. And most states go to about 25%, 11 of the 19 states. So that's a really low figure. And then finally, you have a situation where, you can choose your timing such that you can actually choose a time where you can get the election held as it is being done right now when there's going to be low turnout. And essentially choosing a time when there's going to be low turnout, you ensure that only the very, very intense people, and that tends to be the people who are unhappy about the result of the last gubernatorial result, that they're going to vote. Whereas those folks who are pretty happy with the governor and felt that the governor was just fine are less likely to vote. And so the net result is that in all those ways, this is undemocratic, just in terms of getting it on the ballot. And then we got this ballot, which leads to the situation that Irwin described, where the governor, sitting governor, could get literally just one vote less than 50%. And then the person who wins on the second question could get even less than 18%, could get 10%, 5%, almost anything is possible, but certainly something that one could not consider a Democratic majority. So there's much better ways to do this, and almost every state does it in much better ways. And I can talk more about that if you want to know.
But Irwin, my understanding of this recall process was that it has its roots in progressive politics from about 100 years ago, and that California has a number of mechanisms, including the proposition system, that's designed to try to break the power of political elites and return democracy, you know, back to the people. Is that what was intended? And if so, how the process becomes so altered?
You're right. The recall procedure, like the initiative process, stems from the progressive era. It was a way of empowering the people. I think it's important to note that until 2003, there hadn't been a recall of a governor. And so people didn't focus on how this was set up by the California Constitution. Some of the problems are in the California Constitution. Some of the problems are in the statutes that implement it. So Henry's right. It takes only 12% of the voters in the last election to get a recall on the ballot. In most other states that have recalls, it's 33% or even 40%. That's the statutes. I think that after the last recall election, people just didn't pay attention to it, didn't cure the process. And my hope is that whatever happens on September 14th, we're going to take action at least to amend the election code to change the procedures that can be modified that way. But I would hope we'd also change the California Constitution to create a much more rational process. I don't think it's reasonable or necessary to end the recall process, but I think Henry has outlined the kind of reforms that we need, both in the statutes and in the California Constitution.
So when you're talking about the 12% threshold, is that the number of signatures that's required in order to trigger the recall? Because I know one of the things that's been striking to me is this is not the first attempt to even have a petition to recall Gavin Newsom, correct? There have been numerous petitions, and this one just happened to take hold.
Essentially, every governor for decades has had attempts on the part of people to get a recall petition put together. The trouble is, it used to be that it required sort of formal organizing and really sort of people who were truly sort of concerned about what was going on. Now it turns out you can get companies to go and collect signatures for you. And if you actually have a lot of money, you can get a petition put in place, which is essentially what was done in this case. Let me just say what's odd about all this is that the progressive era reforms were put in place because of the concern about the railroads in California and their tremendous control of the state legislature. In fact, the wonderful novel on this is Frank Norris, The Octopus, which is well worth reading about California and what happened down near Bakersfield. At that time, the only way that popular will could be expressed would be through some kind of populist movement where people got together, and it really was a way to stop the corporations from having so much power. But now, it turns out, actually, it's been turned on its head. A lot of these mechanisms turn out to be ways that corporations or intense parties can have a way to overturn processes that were truly democratic. And that's really not what they were meant to do. And so it's not just that it's a very odd statute and a very odd way to do things. It's also that it turns out it just doesn't do what it once was intended to do.
Irwin, if we go back to this question about financing, then, is what's really striking me. Because again, the progressive era was really about trying to break the financial powers through some sort of popular movement. But it seems that's been one area this has really been turned on its head, that this opens the door where some well-financed, you know, campaign is able to hire these firms. And those of us out here in California know that there's a kind of cottage industry of people who just kind of are always around asking for signatures to put something on a ballot. Is this really been driven by a pretty small number of sort of moneyed interests?
Yes, I think you've got to realize that in this instance, the recall is an effort by the Republicans to gain the governorship, knowing that they're extremely unlikely to win in November 2022. It goes to something that Henry was saying, that if this was on the ballot the next regularly scheduled election, given the Democratic versus Republican registration in California right now, Gavin Newsom would clearly win. The Republicans don't perceive it's likely that they will have a candidate who can defeat Gavin Newsom. And it's not very far from now, just 14 months from now. So their strategy is have a recall on a random Tuesday in September, that those who oppose Gavin Newsom are much more likely to turn out to vote. And this gives them a chance to be able to win the governorship that they otherwise couldn't do. One of the things that troubles me statewide is the impetus of those who lose, sometimes in a close election, to then try to undo that by a recall. So we're seeing in Los Angeles County the effort to recall Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon, who won in a close election. There's a recall effort in San Francisco with regard to District Attorney Chase Boudin. It was just a couple of years ago that we had a recall of a judge in California for the first time since the early 1930s because people didn't like his sentence in a particular case. One thing that I would like to see, in addition to increasing the number of signatures, is requiring bipartisan support to get a recall on the ballot. If you think about a meeting, under Robert's Rules of Order, you have to vote in the majority in order to ask for reconsideration of a decision. It looks like of the signatures that came in for this recall, less than 6% came from registered Democrats.
So that becomes kind of second bite of the apple, if you will, a second crack at an election at a time when we as a country have been wrestling with, you know, relitigating the last election constantly as opposed to looking forward. Is this kind of a logical extension of some of these other broader national trends? Henry Bray, I'll ask you.
I think it's part of what we're seeing, which is that in all sorts of different arenas, and sadly, it's the Republican Party that has decided that it often can't win a majority, and therefore it has to find ways to suppress majorities. There's actually a stream of thought within the Republican Party that argues this is really a good thing. And the stream of thought goes along the lines of, well, there are the people who are the good and the smart and the thoughtful people. And those people should be ensured that they can get a chance to have disproportionate influence, because you certainly don't want the people who aren't so good and so thoughtful to be voting. It's a very, discriminatory kind of perspective on democracy. Democracy, from my perspective, means that everybody has the right to vote. And I believe that really strongly. It may be true that there are some people with more education and know more about some things than other things. But what people individually do know is they know about their own concerns and interests. And it should be the case that they get a chance to express those concerns and interests in a system that's not rigged so that their concerns and interests are simply not recorded. And that's where we are right now. We've got a situation where the Republican Party simply doesn't think that there's a group, that they think a certain group of the population do not deserve, for various reasons, to have their concerns recorded in elections. And I think that's horrible for democracy. And in fact, it leads us towards something more like autocracy, or at least an aristocracy, where certain people have many, many, many more rights than others.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the California recall election, the statutes and the constitutional provisions within the state, and whether it is constitutional and whether it's democratic. Our guests are Erwin Chemerinsky of the UC Berkeley School of Law and Henry Brady of the UC Berkeley School of Public Policy. Now, one thing that's unique, or seemingly unique, and we can get into how other states have done this, but Erwin, I would think that if a governor was recalled, in particular in a state where the lieutenant governor is actually elected independent of the governor, why is there the second question? Why not just the governor's recalled, the lieutenant governor should become governor, right?
I think that's exactly right. And I think it would be better to take an amendment of the California Constitution to say, if the governor is recalled, the lieutenant governor takes over. If Gavin Newsom leaves office for any other reason, the lieutenant governor succeeds him. It makes no sense to say, we're going to have an election and simultaneously decide whether to recall him and choose his successor. And the reason that makes no sense is that strong candidates aren't going to want to run not knowing whether the recall is going to succeed or fail. No viable Democrat is on that list. Last time, Cruz Bustamante put himself on the list, but it was also political suicide for him to do so, and it became a lesson to Democrats this time around.
Cruz Bustamante, by the way, was lieutenant governor at the time.
Yes.
So he was at least on the list, but as you say, it was the end of his career.
But one of the things that kind of saved the 2003 process and at least carried some vestige of legitimacy is the fact that the candidate that got the most votes for governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually got more votes than Gray Davis. So that argument was undermined. That's not likely to happen this time around, is it, Henry?
No, not at all. As Erwin said earlier, that right now, just to give some basic figures, the state's about 47% Democrat, and it's about 24% Republican. So to begin with, it's a very highly Democratic state. Second of all, the polls show very clearly that at least right now, it looks like likely voters, about 55-56%, will vote no on the recall and therefore endorse Gavin Newsom. Now, it's possible because of low turnout and other problems that just could fall slightly below 50%. But then you go to the candidates on the list, and the highest figures for the people on that list are Larry Elder, and nobody's shown a MIA poll that has more than about 25% for Larry Elder, and it's likely he'll get less than that. And so, in effect, what Gavin Newsom could get twice the vote against the recall, that the person who ends up as the governor, if Newsom falls short of 50%, and then the person who then gets the most votes on the second question, that's just really crazy.
There's one other thing, Erwin, about this process that has left me kind of scratching my head, because certainly a lot of the grievances against the 2020 election that the Republicans had leveled is that the rules changed as a result of the pandemic, that there was an expansion of vote by mail, et cetera. But on this recall election, didn't the same thing happen where there was an extension given to secure enough signatures? And if I remember correctly, the pandemic was actually cited as a reason for that, right?
That's exactly right. And many believe that Gavin Newsom made a mistake in not objecting to that. I would go back and I question the premise you started with, that there had been those kinds of changes with regard to the 2020 election. In fact, the Supreme Court prevented the federal courts from imposing changes that I think should have been done to facilitate voting in a pandemic. But yes, as to this recall election, the court extended the time for getting signatures, and Gavin Newsom, maybe out of a commitment to democracy, maybe an error, didn't object, and it made all the difference.
Yeah, and by the way, California already has one of the longest periods you can collect signatures, which is 5 months, whereas most states are 2 or 3 months. So that's just another way in which it's very easy to get a recall petition on the ballot. And why do you want to make that hard? Well, you want to make that hard because you just don't want frivolous groups putting forth petitions for recall. Recall is a very serious thing. And we want to make sure that, in fact, there's a significant group of people who feel that there's a problem before we go and have an election. And by the way, it's also very costly. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars to have this election.
And Henry Brady, to follow that up, you talked about how other states have done recalls. What are some of the more standard practices that other states have? I mean, obviously, a couple we could probably predict is the lieutenant governor becoming governor, but are there some other kind of standard practices?
Yeah, so the two major practices are the lieutenant governor becoming governor. The second practice is that you just have a unified ballot. And whoever gets the most votes, that's the person that wins. You don't have this two ballot scheme, which, as I say, we only share with Colorado, and it is a very, very strange scheme given the way it can work out.
So does that mean then, in that case, Gavin Newsom would be on the ballot, and if he got
on the ballot,
he would win?
There'd be one ballot. It would be a whole list of people. There'd be Gavin Newsom and a lot of other folks, and you could choose which of those people you would vote for. And presumably, again, suppose Gavin Newsom ends up getting less than 50%, but he gets 48%, and the second choice person, Larry Elder, say gets 25%, well, then Newsom would win because he got 48 and Elder got 25%. Furthermore, you could even think about doing ranked choice voting And so in that case, you could eliminate people who get small numbers of votes, reallocate those votes, and eventually get to a majority so that we actually have a majority result. That's perfectly feasible with modern computers and modern voting methods. I'm not so sure, by the way, Erwin, it'd be interesting to discuss whether it should be the lieutenant governor or whether it should be the method I just described where you have one unified ballot.
If we want to keep the recall system, what would make this more democratic, Erwin?
I think we will keep the recall system. I think there is a chance we could get people to amend the Constitution, get the legislature to change the statutes. I don't think that it's likely that people would vote themselves out of power and eliminate the recall. One possibility is just to have the lieutenant governor see the governor. Another is what Henry suggests of a unified ballot. But I also think over the course of this half hour, we've identified many other changes that there need to be. Increase the number of signatures that are necessary to get a recall on the ballot. Shorten the amount of time for gathering those signatures. I'd like to see some requirement for bipartisan support, needing a certain threshold of registered voters from both parties. Have the recall held at the next scheduled election, not, as I said, the random Tuesday in September. Change who succeeds the governor if there is a recall. And I'm ambivalent whether it is the lieutenant governor or a unified ballot. Some of these would take constitutional amendments. Some could be done by statutes. But I hope we all learn a lesson from September 14th. We don't want to go through this process again a year, 2 years, 5 years from now.
Last question here, and we referenced this when you said that kind of the more serious candidates, the more experienced candidates, et cetera, would tend to steer clear of this. Most of the main Republican candidates who we anticipate would be the Republican nominee in 2022. So there's a note that we're going to have another election coming up in slightly over a year. Most of them are on the ballot, though, aren't they? But I know from other things I've read is that they're on the ballot, but they really haven't organized much of a campaign. How much is this a huge challenge that the whole process becomes kind of like a circus, where the candidates who are attempting, to run aren't necessarily serious candidates? Or has this been much more of an organized, campaign on the part of the Republican Party in an attempt to try to replace Gavin Newsom early?
Yeah, I mean, if you want an amusing few hours, read all the bios of the people who are running for the governorship on the second ballot. I mean, some of them are really, it's sort of basically people saying, well, have a nice day. And it's embarrassing for many of those people. It's indeed true that the folks who you might think would be Republican candidates in the next election are running. And I think it's easier for Republicans to run than Democrats. But again, if you had a situation where you had a unified ballot, then obviously the obvious Democrat, which would be the current governor, unless the current governor was so embarrassed by some situation. I mean, we can't imagine a situation in which a governor has done something that we all think is so awful that we really don't want to retain that governor. And if the legislature refuses to impeach the governor, then we would want to have a mechanism where we could rid ourselves of that governor. And so the recall does have a purpose, but it should be based upon fairly severe violations of our trust and of the responsibility that the governor has.
And of course, as a reminder, we've seen a governor acting in a way that was deserving of being removed, and New York was fully capable of getting rid of their governor without going through this recall.
But the recall, especially when you have, as we have, highly democratic legislatures, you could see a circumstance where it's possible that, although in New York they actually acted responsibly, but it's possible that they might not in California for some reason, in which case you would want to have the additional opportunity to bring the people into the situation so that, in fact, you could rid yourself of that person.
But it has to be structured so it's the last resort. Mm-hmm. The other mechanisms don't work. What we do in California is make it so easy, it's not a last resort at all. It's a chance for a political party that couldn't otherwise win to try to use this mechanism, or for those who lose a close election to try to undo it.
Now, if the likely outcome of this election, if the polls are accurate, that Newsom ends up not being recalled, and we come to the conclusion that this was just a big waste of time and perhaps even more so of money. Do you anticipate that there's going to be a desire to try to change the Constitution? Or is there going to be kind of a sense of, hey, we survived this one, so there's no need to change the process, Henry?
I think there's going to be an attempt. I've been talking to a lot of people around the state about this. And I think there's a lot of folks who are saying, we got to do something about this. There was, by the way, a good New York Times editorial, which talked about changing the process here in California. I think absolutely that folks are going to get together and they're going to say, something's got to be done here because this is a bit of an embarrassment.
And Erwin, sort of the last word here, is the lesson here that something that was intended to be a process of direct democracy can always be manipulated by moneyed interests to try to serve their own interests? Or am I being too cynical about the whole process?
Yeah. I'm uncomfortable generalizing. This is a process that was created over a century ago. I think the most that I would say is there can often be unintended consequences to things that are set up. And I don't think anyone, when they created this process, envisioned the type of situation that we're facing right now, that you could have someone end up with 48 or 49% of the voters wanting the individual stay in office and a candidate favored by 18 or 20% replacing them. We've seen that's a realistic possibility, even if it doesn't happen. I agree with Henry. It's got to be the impetus for reform.
And with that, I want to thank our guests. We've been discussing the constitutionality and the democratic implications of the California recall process and the upcoming California recall election. Our guests have been Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Choper, Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Berkeley Law School. He's the author of We the People, a Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, and Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And Henry Brady, former Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age, and The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.